Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
So, you just got promoted to manager? Great, you're the boss now. Are you ready to lead? Those of us at middle age who have worked for someone else for more than a few years have undoubtedly had great bosses and some not so great. And the quality of the boss makes a world of difference, doesn't it? Not just at work, but in your entire life. Desire to go into work on Monday morning, camaraderie around the office, cooperation on projects, your initiative to suggest new ways of doing things. Not even how it feels going home in the evening, being all stressed out, ready for a drink and mindless TV watching, or a bright and cheery family dinner followed by friendly conversation or an activity with a spouse and kids. And then do you sleep sound or restless tossing and turning, waking up tired and depressed, ready for another bad day at the office? Even if you like the tasks you perform and are proud of the company you work for, a bad boss can suck warm feelings and energy right out of you. And if you are a boss or a team leader, brand new or experienced, you certainly don't want those reporting to you to be resentful, low on energy, and wishing that you'd move on. Lord knows there are tons of business leadership books out there, and like me, you probably read a lot. A few of them, but a lot of them offer complex theories on leadership by psychologists and business school professors. But how about some common sense leadership essentials by someone who's been there and done that? And that's what we have for you today. My guest is Dana Oliver, who for more than 30 years has led R&D teams in the medical devices industry. And he's here to share his unique style of mantra leadership, as he calls it, for effectively leading everything from an ad hoc team to an entire company from the executive suite. And Dana Oliver, for the past 12 years, has been Senior Director of R&D for Medtronic, a world leader in medical technology. And during 30 years in R&D with several companies, he's led cross-functional product development teams and successful intro of products that have generated hundreds of millions of dollars in sales. He himself has been granted 15 U.S. patents to date, and he's author of the excellent new book, Mantra Leadership, Don't Become the Emperor with No Clothes. And hello, Dana, and welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age.
Roy, thank you very much for inviting me to your show, and I very much appreciate your program and agree with it. I think it's great.
Well, please briefly describe mantra leadership. What does it entail? I understand from the intro it was born out of 30 years of your personal experience and on-the-job observations, but what is mantra leadership?
I think that's a great question, Roy, and I'd tell you that it's my leadership style, and what I've done is I've distilled down those 30 years of experience, and I, by nature, use a lot of mantras, but the mantras all evolve around emotionally intelligent leadership, and if you employ emotionally intelligent leadership, and it's a little bit of a paradox in the world today, but if you do, you can increase your team's productivity by as much as 30% or more by just tapping into, you know, treating them as professionals, understanding their work, and taking interest in what they do. In the whole book, each chapter is predicated on a mantra, and then each mantra has a corollary to an emotionally intelligent trait.
Oh, I see. Well, based on your observations, do most companies adequately prepare first-time team leaders and managers, or are most of them just sort of thrown into the fray without much real...
No. You're absolutely, it's a fantastic insight, Roy. And the reality is that the average person gets promoted because they're good at they're good at their job.
Amen.
But they're rudimentally prepared for becoming a manager, never mind a leader, which is, you know, even far different. I mean, you'll find some very good training programs at some of the biggest companies. So if you look at companies like Johnson & Johnson or Medtronic in the medical sectors, they certainly have designed leadership programs. And I think those are really good. To your point, a lot of them are philosophical in nature. So my approach with the book was to try to create something from a tried and true way, you know, been there, done that, and break that into simple bite-sized chapters and mantras. And mantras, one of the reasons they're so important is when you become a leader or even a manager, it's important to be consistent. And it's important to have consistent messaging. So using mantras are simple, and they allow you to be consistent in your talk.
Yeah. Why did you subtitle your book, Don't Become the Emperor with No Clothes? Why are so many of today's leaders, both new and experienced, in danger of becoming like this emperor?
Thank you for the question, and I'm happy that you picked up on that, Roy. I think that's effectively the last chapter in the book, and it's predicated on the old fairy tale, you know, about the emperor that didn't wear any clothes, and about the young boy, you know, who pointed out to his mother. And the whole basis of the story was that this emperor was swindled by two swindlers who realized that he loved beautiful clothes. And he went, and the swindlers went to them and said, "Look, you know, if you're big in your thought and you're intelligent and you're royal, you'll be able to see these beautiful clothes." So the emperor, of course, didn't want to suggest that he was anything but. So of course he saw the clothes.
And many lessons in it, doesn't it? First of all, leader is too proud to really ask for criticism or advice. And then secondly, the people working for him who were probably been intimidated if he isn't an effective leader don't want to be the first ones to deliver the bad news that he's naked.
Lessons. It's fantastic because in leadership it's all about truth, transparency, and honesty. And if you want to have a great team, you want people to trust you and respect you. But part of that is you want people to be sincere and to tell you the truth. Yeah. The reality is, if you're so steadfast on people telling you how great you are, and you don't think and you think you're perfect and you're not going to evolve, then the reality is you're going to be a sad leader at best, because what got you where you are today won't get you to where you need to be tomorrow.
Yes,
you need to have insight and understand and truth. And that'll help you understand. Everyone has blind spots.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone does. So part of, and that's another thing, is constructive criticism. So if you want to really be a good leader, you need to learn to give constructive criticism.
Yeah.
You need to take it. And people need to understand that when someone's given it to you, that if you listen to it right, you can grow from what they're saying.
Yeah, that's so crucial in constructive criticism, both as a leader and as a follower who wants to get ahead and move forward. You can take it as an insult and take it personally and fret over it and be down and out, or you can say, "Hey, that's really great that I was told this, because I can change that." And so few people, I think, are able to do that effectively, to really take it in as positive motivation to do better. But some, I guess, do. And if the right boss tells you that, then you're much more likely to be receptive than this, he's always or she's always looking for something to criticize.
It's all about approach, Roy.
Yeah.
It's funny, I was reading that as many as 70% of all leaders choose not to give constructive criticism because they're afraid to hurt someone's feeling.
Yeah,
yet an entire industry, you know, if you look at executive coaching, the entire industry was born out of people not being able to give, you know, effective performance reviews.
Yeah,
and the reality is,
true.
To your point, it's either fight or flight. If someone starts to give you, you know, constructive criticism, a lot of people, they look at that as being, they get angry or they get it defensive.
Yeah.
What you need to do is you need to check your emotions at the door and look at it objectively and say, "Hey, is this something I can learn to get better and improve?" And the reality is, when you're a line worker and you're managing yourself, and then you go to maybe leading a small one- or two-person team, or maybe even a 5- to 10-person team, it's far different when you have to start learning to lead a department or multiple businesses. And so your appearance, what you say, how you act, trust me, you can't get there without someone telling you what you do good today versus where there are opportunities for improvement tomorrow. I mean, that's how they groom precedents, you know, for Christ's sakes today. You know, there's lots of people in the back room telling them what shoes to wear, what tie, and, you know, how to speak, right?
So everyone except Donald Trump, he knows it all and doesn't need any advice because he's a multi-billionaire, right?
I guess we're on for a wild ride here. I would have never thought the day.
Well, I shouldn't be. This program's not about politics, but my wife often says I'm great in books, but I don't understand or relate well with people. And what is emotional intelligence exactly, and where should we go to develop ours? Is it something that you're born with, or can you learn to have some emotional intelligence?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question, Roy. And first, I think, you know, emotional intelligence, or you know, otherwise EI, as it's also known, people have always linked that to soft skills. And they might think, oh, you know, you're a good listener, or you understand when I'm down, or, you know, you can read the expression on my face. And emotional intelligence is indeed that. It is soft skills. But emotionally intelligent leadership, and this is a fundamental difference, that when you go back to Daniel Goleman's book, Primal Leadership, he measured essential emotional intelligence skills. And there's probably around, you know, 15 different skills.
Yeah.
And he realized and identified after evaluating multiple leaders that if you have a critical mass of at least 7 emotionally intelligent skills, you then are perceived to be an exceptional leader compared to leaders who have less of those critically 7. But also because there's 15, there's a myriad of potential leadership styles that you can embrace.
Yes.
The key, though, is to find the critical mass. And again, that's what I try to highlight in the book, is point out, you know, small things, but employ emotionally intelligence.
Yeah. And emotional intelligence applies not just to your own emotions, but to understand your own emotions, the emotions of others and of groups of people. I know you point out that in your book, or I guess that was a Wikipedia definition you quoted somewhere in the book.
And it's like anything, right? I mean, I think a great leader, you know, even amongst a crowd of people, can make any one given person feel really special and connected to. I mean, there's a lot of great speakers that, you know, people feel, my God, I'm one in an audience, but I feel like that individual was talking right to me.
Speakers I've heard like that, that you really felt like they were speaking just to you.
Right. It's a true gift. And I think that's also part of leadership. Leadership is practice. Leadership's no different than becoming a mathematician or becoming a great golfer. I mean, you don't become a golfer because you buy a new set of clubs. You do it because you practice the swing and practice and practice and practice, and you become better at that. Leadership is no different, and that's part of the constructive criticism and the reading and the growing. You need to pick up tricks. You know, one of my tricks was through my career, I would begin to jot down. I would read leadership books. I'd highlight and write down the things I liked, and then the things I didn't really care for, I would just disregard. But then I would go back to them and practice, you know, the things I like. You know, little things like keeping your office door open. Your door is the first access to you, and if people can't get to you, then how do you begin to influence them?
Yeah, I love that. One of your mantras is to say good morning, where when you come in the morning, you look everyone in the eye and say good morning, and that, like you say, it's kind of opening up, saying I'm open for business. You know, come in and discuss your problems, and I'm here to listen. And rather than just shutting that door and, you know, communicating with the other people, the vice presidents and all the people on your level, and cutting out the closing out the.
It's awful when people, Roy, when people would say, hey, you know what, hey, I got to go talk to the boss. Is he in a good mood, or is she in a good mood? Well, really? I mean, to me, it should be. So that's why I do. I say good morning. Hey, if I had a fight with my spouse, that, you know, I can't bring that to work. I'm going to walk in the door and say, look, I'm approachable.
Yeah.
You know, so everyone I see, I want to look them in the eyes. I want to disarm anything, any troubles. And I think there's something else to be said about that, too, is as an executive, you tend to learn to speak over a lot of things quickly, and you begin to give constructive and sometimes some curt, you know, conversations can take place. And people can carry those conversations around for weeks or months. And
yeah.
So if all of a sudden the next time you see them, let's just say, you know, you didn't make eye contact, their
yeah.
immediate thought is, oh, my God, the guy's still mad at me.
Yeah.
Well, that's part of the whole emotional intelligence is when you begin to look and think how people react, well, okay, just disarm that whole idea. It's simple. Say hi.
Yeah.
Look people in the eye.
Yeah, we don't have time to cover all the individual leadership mantras in your book, but let's discuss a couple of them. What do you mean by the mantra number one, culture is the byproduct of leadership? I like that, but why don't you explain that a little bit of what that means?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I open up the book with that because I think for leaders, it's truly important. It's easy to for people to speak words. So example, people might say, hey, I have an open door policy, right?
Yeah.
So a leader gets up, I have an open door policy, and everyone needs to realize open door is supposed to be for honesty and transparency and
yeah.
come in to discuss issues and create camaraderie between bosses and employees. But
yeah.
what happens the first time you go into that boss's office and you go in to talk or maybe try to discuss a problem, he's not looking at you. He's checking emails on his computer. He's kind of periodically looking over at you and kind of grunting, acknowledging
yeah.
that you're there, but really is not paying attention.
Kind of grudgingly acknowledging you're there, like you'd
right.
rather you weren't.
So what happens to that employee, especially if that employee came in and he had something important on his mind to say,
yeah.
do you think he's going to come back?
No,
do you think
probably
he's
not.
He's probably not. So the culture, the words, I have an open door.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying. But
yeah.
the underlying message to the employees, when you go in there, if you don't give them your full attention, look them in the eye, pay
yeah.
attention, absorb what they're saying, return feedback, the culture, the underlying culture is, I really don't care. Those are just
yeah.
words. So
yeah, I like the point in your book where you said that actually that the people working for you's time is much more important than your time if you're a leader, you know, to listening
oh.
to what their problems are and their challenges and their new ideas, obviously.
Well, a leader's time is multiplicative, and that's
yeah.
one of the first things I try to teach people. So, example, I like to just use simple numbers, but if you have a staff of 100 people, and
yeah.
you go in one, you close your door. So think about the connotation. You're saying, I'm more important, don't bother me. That's
yeah.
what your door says.
Yeah.
Two, if people have to bother you, they're going to say, excuse me, or they're just going to wander around until your door is open.
Yeah.
Now, if by chance those 100 people don't have a clear priority, if you've not articulated that great, or if there's some challenge,
yeah.
for every 1 hour you have that you think you're important doing work, you've lost 100 man hours of time.
What a good point. That's exactly right.
So the key is you think of your time as less important. So
yeah.
I rarely ever close my door. I do if it's, you know, it's a one-on-one or,
yeah.
you know, I'm talking cash or there's
yeah.
obviously reasons. But the rest of the time, I always have my door open
yeah.
and I want to make sure that I'm on top of things and my people know exactly what they need to do. And
yeah,
I'm an
I like this, you know, sort of on the same vein. I like this mantra number four. What is the 24-hour rule and how does this apply to leadership?
Oh, it's a great rule. A great, great rule. And so, example, it's funny. People see things happen all the time. It could be a good thing. It could be a
yeah.
bad thing.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of things that happen that don't elevate to the level of HR. So
yeah.
what I mean by that is maybe someone you saw this person was on the border of bullying. He was in front of somebody. He was talking kind of loud. He was getting into their space.
Yeah.
You know, there was no fisticuffs and
yeah.
it wasn't yelling, but it was just posturing.
Yeah.
So all of you can let that go and that person will never learn. So
yeah.
one of my rules, the 24-hour rule is, and it does two things. One, if I see something that I don't care for or even if I do care for, if I like
yeah.
it, hey,
yeah.
I'll make sure I send a quick email or a phone call or a pat on the back to say, hey, that's great, keep doing it. If
yeah.
there's something I don't care for, I'll professionally. So first, I'll give people the due credit. I don't pass judgment. I'll say,
yeah.
you know, example, hey, Roy, not a biggie. When you have 5 minutes, can you just come see me for a minute? Just need to talk about a couple things and
yeah.
get aligned. So I kind of disarm you from being concerned. You come in to my office. I do it privately, closed door. I don't yell. And I just say, hey, Roy, look, I happen to see you talking to a colleague, and I just want to give you some feedback and just to be sure that you were getting a little close. I thought you had an agitated profile. Your voice was increasing. Clearly, all these are signs of tension and aggression. Just want to make sure that I point that out to you. And we have to be careful. Those things, maybe you had a tough day, and let's talk about that. But I want you to be aware. Because some people, their culture, depending on where they come from in the world, it might be more natural. So it's a leader's job to calibrate and align people. The other thing the rule does, Roy, is that this, in order to begin giving people candid feedback, people are uncomfortable with confrontation. So what I do as a new leader, if I have a new person in my group, I give them 24 hours. So if I see something and this is a report into them, I force them to go have that conversation because it's easy to procrastinate, and procrastination leads to avoidance.
Yeah,
and so people will never learn to have difficult conversations. And most of these, I find when I have them, most of the people say, oh, my God, Dana, thank you. Thank you. I didn't realize I was doing that.
If it's handled the right way, that would probably be the reaction. If it's handled the wrong way, then you get resentment and defensiveness and stuff. But you're obviously handling it the right way then.
And it goes back to emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
So so the key is you can't accost somebody. You can't assume that they're wrong. You need to disarm the situation and then just ask them, hey, I saw this. You know, maybe there's a reason behind it. Help me understand. And so it's all the approach. It's the leadership is not hard, but it is purposeful.
Yeah. Well, you, I think in your book there's what, like 14 mantras you present, or do I have the wrong number? It's somewhere.
Right. That's close enough.
And you have, like you said, each chapter is most of the chapters anyway, other than an intro and a conclusion, is related to one of those mantras, and then you go into helpful suggestions on how you should adopt that mantra and how it would work. And I think that's a great way to do it, because even if, like you say, you don't adopt every one of the suggestions that you have in your book, if you get that critical mass of those effective mantras that work, you're going to be a much better leader, obviously, than you have been, or you're going to be an effective leader. So,
And I think, Roy, when you even opened the show, you talked about a lot of leadership is philosophical. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is that I've read a lot of leadership books, and I've had a lot of great takeaways. But I can tell you they weren't very practical.
Yeah,
so my approach is, look, I've been doing this a long time, and I would consider I'm pretty good at it. And so I'm trying to share real-life ways, and I tried to build the book so that anywhere along, if you're going to become a leader, I've built it to understand culture, understand how to hire, understand how to have honest conversations, you know, honest performance reviews with people, understand how to discipline people, how to understand how to let people go, how to create, you know, a happy culture. So I've looked at it very systematically. So any person, I'm sure there's a takeaway, whether you're, you know, an aspiring leader or whether you're a seasoned leader, I'm sure there's something in there that you go, hey, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, your book, once again, is Mantra Leadership, Don't Become the Emperor with No Clothes. And where should we go to preview and purchase that book? Do you have a website?
I do. I have a website. Thank you for asking, Roy. It's obviously www.mantraleadership.com. And that's all one word, mantraleadership.com.
Yeah.
And then conversely, you can buy it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Ex Libris, who was my publisher.
Oh, I see. Well, in conclusion, same as Dana, I've worked in corporate America for about 18 years before I got coughed out and started my own little small business. But I had some great bosses and some bad bosses. And let me tell you, the quality of boss had a major influence on my entire life and those of my colleagues, including my family and friends, because the quality of boss also made a world of difference in what I contributed on the job, but also how I enjoyed life in general and what I thought about myself. And just every aspect of life can be influenced by a bad boss. And whether or not we have a formal leadership role at work right now, every one of us is also a leader at home with our kids and in our community, and we can be an effective leader there or a very ineffective one. And just because you're a master of your profession and have outstanding technical knowledge and skills doesn't make you a good leader. And if you are in or soon will be promoted to a leadership role, I highly recommend you check out Dana Oliver's book, Leadership Mantra: Don't Become an Emperor with No Clothes. And once you're in a leadership role, continually ask for feedback from your peers and especially from those who work for you. And like Dana instructs, say good morning and have that open door policy and mean it. I once worked for a company where the big boss had a secretary out there that would practically tackle you if you tried to walk into his office. And we don't need that kind of that was obviously a pretty pretty formal and strained type organization. We don't need that. And thanks so much, Dana Oliver, for your most enlightening comments on leadership.
Roy, it's been a real pleasure speaking to you, sir, and I hope to have an opportunity to come back and talk to you again about it. It's one of my favorite topics.
There's so many aspects of leadership. Maybe you can come back sometime to talk about people at middle age managing younger workers or handling us people of middle age and on, because there's so many intergenerational issues now and so many issues related to leadership. It would be fascinating to have you back sometime. And thanks so much for joining us today on Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age. And now all of you present and inspiring emperors, let's all go out and put some clothes on. It may get cold tonight. Well, thanks to today's guest, Dana Oliver, for his insightful suggestions on effective leadership. And I'd like to close today's program with a few suggestions for managers, young and old, and company leaders on how to effectively lead seasoned employees, those of us over age 45. You know, in recharging your business or not-for-profit enterprise, we seasoned employees can be staunch allies or significant obstacles to change. Properly inspired, long-tenured employees contribute a unique combination of job skills, an historical perspective on company operations, on life in general, on industry dynamics, and on customer preferences. On the minus side, uninspired veterans sometimes lead a reactionary charge against the infusion of fresh ideas or the introduction of new methods of operation. And if I'm a long-term individual contributor or first-line manager in my late 40s, 50s, or 60s, excuse me, I may resent a boss or manager my own age or even younger telling me how to do my job. I've been around and know as much or more about this business than my boss, so why should she or he be telling me how to do my job? My way of doing things has always worked well in the past. To add to my trepidation, I may be fearful of being let go in today's economy when it's difficult, if not impossible, for those of us over 50 to find a new job. Fear makes it very uncomfortable for me to propose change or to experiment with new ideas, and I'm pretty scared of all this new high-tech stuff as well. As a representative of our graying North American workforce, here are a few suggestions for company leaders, young and old. Here is what we most want from you. Request number one, please communicate clearly what you expect from us. Effective two-way communication is an absolute necessity, and I mean two-way, if we are able to work together in harmony. You and us do not always view the world or work assignments from an identical perspective, and do not simply assume that because we have been around for a while, we automatically fathom precisely what you want from us. You know, it's okay to inform us of the targeted end result, but please stick around long enough to receive our input before you hand out work assignments and move on. We prefer at least some personal discretion in organizing our daily tasks, And also, please keep us informed of overall company performance trends and pending challenges. We don't like information vacuums, and we abhor unpleasant surprises. Doesn't matter what your age is, everyone does that. Challenge number two is to respect our experience, both on the job and in life. Whatever the challenge, it's probable that one or more of your seasoned subordinates has been there and done that. You know, the 55-year-old former homemaker who was on her first job in years outside the home can contribute a wealth of organization, conceptual, and human relations skills. So always look beyond formal education or lack thereof and immediate employment history to mine the hidden talents and gold mines of and capabilities gained through years of adult living. Challenge number three is to make us feel special. Without doubt, some of your tenured subordinates resent having been passed over for a more senior position, including the job you now hold, and you can overcome that resentment by demonstrating time and again how essential each one of us is as a member of your team. Sometimes all a long-term employee needs is a sincere thank you for a job well done. Recognize what they're doing and then tell them they're doing a good job at it. It helps if you routinely request seasoned employee input before you make crucial decisions that impact them. And if asked, most tenured veterans will be honored to serve as role models or to help train less experienced colleagues so long as they're not overloaded in the process. And your old-timers most certainly deserve an occasional merit raise, incentive bonus, or alternative fund or monetary or non-monetary reward for extraordinary performance. And challenge number four is offer us the training we need or desire, regardless of our age and experience. Simply because we're over 50 and unlikely ever to be promoted to a higher job in your company, that does not mean we have no desire or a need to learn new skills or explore fresh horizons. Not unlike our younger colleagues, we need to remain abreast of the latest technological advancements and to receive coaching and other advice on how to enjoy more out of work and out of life in general. And same as most of you, we're proud of our position and we want to do the best we can. So regardless of age, keeping us up to date is a sound investment. And here's challenge number five. If you don't need, to continually remind us that you are the boss. In all likelihood, those of us over 45 grew up in a traditional command and control business environment, and we are well aware that you're the one in charge. Despite our disappointment at not being higher up at our age, we respect your authority and will follow your lead so long as you demonstrate competence, integrity, and impartiality in doling out work assignments, promotions, and bonuses, and so long as you contribute your time and effort yourself. You know, I always used to resent a boss that handed out work assignments that would require us to work late in the evening, and then he always went home right at 5 o'clock. You know, if you inspire us as a coach, we'll pull together as a team. And here's challenge number six. Please acknowledge that we have a lot to lose. Most of your older subordinates have invested many years in your company and in our careers, so it's easy to understand our overriding desire for job security. At our age, it might be impossible to locate a comparable position in another company, and we have pensions invested in a number of other things that we need to take care of. We're also concerned about adequate health insurance, educating our children, and financing retirement. Does your company offer attractive pension plan accumulation investing and a generous company 401k contribution? Can employees choose from cafeteria-style benefit options, which they can alter as they as their kids grow and leave the nest? And these kind of cafeteria options that will enhance our sense of well-being. We know that the future can't be guaranteed, but it is fair to ask for assurance of continued employment and advancement so long as we meet our or exceed realistic performance criteria and company finances remain sound. And by advancement, I don't necessarily mean in promotion to a higher position, but it may be just continued enhancement and raises as the company succeeds. And challenge number seven, above all else, please do not stereotype us and assume that we're unable to adapt to change. You know, every employee in their late 40s, 50s, or 60s is a unique, living, and breathing human being, not a stereotypical member of the baby boom generation. I'm so tired of that term. Challenge us with new projects and ideas. More than a few of us are open to bold, new, mid-career experimentation, radical new technologies, and unconventional organization structures. And yes, we do know how to use iPads, iPods to block and to blog, and to interface with colleagues on Facebook. And to summarize, empower your onboard veterans, eliminate every vestige of age discrimination, create an information democracy, elicit feedback from us, and enlist your most trusted seniors as deputy agents of change. Is there any reason not to honor and engage qualified older employees up until our final day on the job? And a leadership team generally committed to seasoned employee motivation, heck, to motivating employees at any age, is well on its way to enhancing the most cherished asset, your uniquely qualified collection of senior contributors who drive day-to-day operations. And for additional ideas on seasoned employee motivation, plus a whole host of information and a comprehensive roadmap to company revival, take a look at my newest book, Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines by Roy C. Richards. You know, you can find that on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Also, to preview the book and receive a free gift and learn a whole lot more, go to our website, middleagerenewal.com. And that's it for today on Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age. See you all again next week and enjoy the fall.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.